All right. If you would, open up to Matthew chapter 20. We're going to refer just a little bit back to the verses that came before, verses 1 through 16 that we covered last week. But we're going to do it a little bit sporadically. If you weren't here last week and didn't get a chance to stay up to date with the recordings that are on YouTube, we're going to go back and look at things a little bit as they start to show up in the next few verses. If you remember the story about the vineyard, about different shifts come in, first shift's hired, then a 9 o'clock, a 12 o'clock, a 3 o'clock, and a 5 o'clock. The day ends at 6 o'clock, sunset, evening. And then comes the payment that's out. That's the same for everybody, no matter whether you worked all day or you just worked 1 hour. Only the first group made the agreement. Everyone else just agreed to be paid what was right. And they trusted the owner of the vineyard. Then he finishes, here's verse 16. He says, so the last shall be first and the first last. You see this theme show up. It finished chapter 19. It's here in chapter 20. We're going to see it again as we go further on through chapter 20. He says, the last shall be first and the first last. And that's one of those statements that comes around, but people just kind of say it sometimes, just in general. And what is really the idea behind this? If you're going to put yourself first, what's going to happen? You'll be made last. However, if you put God's desires first, and you put yourself last, God's going to lift you up, and He's going to take care of you. So, as you notice what's in place, look at verse 17. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, He took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and on the way He said to them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn Him to death, and will hand Him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify Him, and on the third day He will be raised up. Now, notice, who's the audience? It's just the 12. And I want you to notice, it fills in 12 disciples. And you know how that works through the Gospel of Matthew. He's talking about his 12 apostles. And you start thinking through those 12 apostles. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. I mean, those aren't the apostles. Those are the Gospels. So you start thinking in terms of, all right, how about Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James, the son of Alphaeus, Simon, Thaddeus, Judas Iscariot. You start thinking of these men all together. And when you think about that group, there's some things that we know. There's some things that maybe we guess. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, what's their occupation? Fishermen. Are they used to working hard? Yes. Think about Matthew, the tax collector. So, you know, he's got a little bit of an accounting background. You think in terms of a man by the name of Simon the Zealot. He's very zealous against the government, which you go, how would he and Matthew get along? One who collects taxes, one who doesn't care for government control. If you take the name Bartholomew, it literally means the son of the farmer. So I'm going to assume he's an agriculture type guy. You look at this group together and you go, they're an interesting group. It may not be what you would expect. And yet at this point in time, he's just told this parable, but now he gets his 12 by themselves and he's about to tell them who's going to put himself last. And who will it be? Jesus. And where's he going to end up because he's going to put himself last? He's going to be king in this kingdom that he's been talking about. Because what was the parable really about? The kingdom of heaven is to be compared to a vineyard, a landowner. Now, specifically verse 17, Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem. And remember, you always go up to Jerusalem because Jerusalem's elevation. So don't get confused in terms of north, south, east, and west. That's not what up means to them. They think about people who travel by foot. So Here it is, going up to Jerusalem. He took the 12 aside by themselves, and on the way, he said to them. So as they're traveling, you ever have good conversations as you travel with others? Oh, yeah, that can be really fun. Verse 18, this is what he wants to tell them. Now, they know where they're going. And Jesus, if they don't know, tells them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death. Now, how has everything been going for Jesus? It hasn't been easy, but what? Lots of people coming to him. And to think, here you are with your 12 apostles, and then you tell them, number one, here's where we're going. We're going to Jerusalem. And what does Jerusalem literally mean? City of peace. Remember Shalom, peace? Jeru is the Hebrew word for city. So Jerusalem's supposed to be a city of peace. What is Jesus saying? It's not going to be for him. Then he says, the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests. Are they aware of who the Son of Man is? You're like, yes, no, maybe so. All right, let's take a look. Look back at Matthew chapter 16. I want you to look at the question that Jesus poses. Matthew 16, look at verse 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, which is up in the northeast, he says, he was asking his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Now, notice their response. Verse 14. They said, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. Now, this is about what do people say. And then now look at the next question. Verse 15. But he said to them, but who do you say that I am? So do they understand the Son of Man concept about being about Jesus? Because the very next statement after this is, verse 16, Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So did they understand that the Son of Man was Jesus? They did. They understand that principle. Now, the term Son of Man, I don't know whether you realize it or not, it shows up 29 times just in the Gospel of Matthew. And we could take the rest of our time this morning and just look through all of those, but we're not going to. The term Son of Man is used 80 times in the Gospel accounts alone. And yet after the Gospel accounts, it's only used twice because it's no longer a secret. And one of the times that it shows up is in Acts. It's whenever Stephen's being stoned to death for his faithfulness to God. And it says, and he saw the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. So what do we know for certain who this Son of Man is? Definitely Jesus. Then the other time shows up over in Hebrews chapter 2. But come back over to Matthew chapter 20. So when Jesus makes this statement about the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes and they will condemn him to death, they understood he was talking about himself. It's nothing hidden. And he's used this kind of terminology all through the Gospel of Matthew. So sometimes we might read that and go, well, is he really talking about himself? Would they know that? And I want you to realize they would certainly know that. Then the idea that he's going to be condemned by the religious leaders, does that kind of hit you sideways if you're one of those 12? Like, they're supposed to be honest people. They're supposed to have integrity. They're supposed to be holy people. And these religious leaders, and you're telling us that you're going to go to Jerusalem and we're going to go with you and you're going to be condemned to death by the scribes, those same men who copy the Old Testament to write another copy of it, and they can't even make a mistake? I mean, if you think about how scribes would really work, they would gather, maybe not necessarily in a room like this, but they would gather and they have a whole bunch of scribes out together. There might be 20 or 30 of them, just depends on the setting. There'd be one person who would stand up and they would read whatever was being copied. And everybody in the room would make a copy. And then after it was over, they would start to read through one another's copies. And if they found mistakes, you know what they would do with them? They would destroy them. They would burn them because they weren't going to be copies with integrity. And so here scribes, this is what they do. They read this, they copy this, they should know the old covenant through in backwards and forwards, we would say. And they go, and those are the people who are going to destroy Jesus, condemn him to death. Now, the chief priests, I mean, you go, well, these are men who are Levites. They would certainly know. They're supposed to understand these things. He says, and they're going to condemn him to death. And you can appreciate how Jesus is talking about himself in the third person as the Son of Man. He says, and they're going to condemn him to death. And then you might be thinking, and what kind of death are we referring to? Old age? Going to die in a prison? Verse 19. Nope. And will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him. Now, when he says the Gentiles, who's he really talking about? Fill in the blank. The Romans. It's interesting to me that whenever it comes time for Jesus to be put to death, the Jews actually want to take Jesus to the Romans so that the Romans are the ones who actually kill Jesus. They don't want his blood on their hands, even though it is. However, whenever you get to Acts chapter 7 and Stephen's being stoned, what do they not do? They don't appeal to the Romans. Yet whenever they go to Pilate, they make a statement like, well, we have a law that he should die, but you know we're not supposed to kill anybody, so we brought him to you. Where was that thinking in Stephen's day? Nowhere to be found. Now, that's over in Acts chapter 7. But notice here, he says, the Romans are going to mock him, and if you flash forward, you know how. They're going to mock him in terms of, they're going to wrap him up in a purple robe. And Matthew's account is going to talk about even it being scarlet. And how did it turn from purple to scarlet? By his own blood. And they put that on him after they scourge him. So you just imagine that robe soaking up all that blood. And he says, and I know that's coming. They would slap him with their fists. They would beat him. Remember, they took a reed and put it in his hand, a mock scepter. And they beat him on the head with it. Crown of thorns, all those things included. And here's Jesus saying, they will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge. And you think about that idea about being scourged. You're talking about putting yourself last. Because what authority and power did Jesus have? Think about what could he have done in that moment? Could he have stopped it if he wanted to? What was he having to make a decisive choice about? I'm going to do my Father's will. I'm going to put myself last. And you realize, last. Not only below the religious leaders, not only below the Gentiles and the Romans, not only below the soldiers who were to carry out the scourgings. When you think about a scourging, literally that idea of being tied to a post with your hands above your head, stretching out the back muscles and the skin, and then having a soldier whose job is to take a whip to lacerate with little shards of bone and metal and glass, and to really just shred the back. How often would he have to choose to be last? Every second. And you realize, here he is, showing them what it's like to be last. And knowing full well that's not the end. Then they would take him out to be crucified. And notice how Jesus is already aware of these things. And he knows them from the Old Testament. And so here it is. He says, mock, scourge, crucify him. He says, and on the third day he will be raised up. But what does he know is coming? Because what happens to those who put themselves last? Not only do they come to be first, but they are raised up. You don't stay at the last. Now Jesus will be first. Who's he having to trust for that? God. So how does that tie in with us? Are we going to choose to put ourselves last and rely upon God to put us where we need to be? Or are we the kind of people who want to be first and then think that's really where God wanted us all along anyway? Now, I want you to notice, because really the rest, all of chapter 20 deals with that parable that's in the first 16 verses. Jesus tells them specifically these details. Now, whether they understand everything that has to do with, I doubt it. I can't tell you definitively at this point. But then notice verse 20. And you can read a parallel account of this over in the Gospel of Mark chapter 10. It says, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. All right, who are the sons of Zebedee? James and John, two of the apostles. So here it is. Jesus has been telling about, here's what it's like to put yourself last and to let the Lord raise you up. Then comes this next scene. It says, the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons. Now, James and John, what ages are you considering them to be? They're not teenagers. Adults. 30s would be my guess, but I can't prove it. And to go, here it is, of going, they're adults, you know that much. And to go, and your mother's going to take you? Doesn't this sound kind of odd? I mean, almost borderline embarrassing. Now, he says, but I want you to notice what's her attitude and what's their attitude. Bowing down and making a request. Now, this sounds very respectful, right? Even worshipful in the sense of prostrating yourself, bowing down. And to go, I want to make a request. And then look at Jesus' response, verse 21. And he said to her, notice, said to her, not to them, said to her, what do you wish? Can you imagine Jesus asking that to you? What do you wish? Now, do you think she loves her boys? We'll certainly assume that. She said to him, command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit one on your right and one on your left. What does she have full faith in about Jesus? He's going to rule a kingdom. So does she have great faith? And to go, whenever you rule, and specifically notice the way that it's kind of worded, that in your kingdom, well, if it's his kingdom, who's the king? He is. Typically, we think of kings as having what kind of authority? All. We think of highest. So she says, well, I have a great faith about this kingdom that's coming. He says, and you're going to be the one who stands in control. I have a request to ask. Well, what do you wish? She says, command that in your kingdom, these two sons of mine, I imagine James and John standing right there. He says, these two sons of mine may sit one on your right and one on your left. He says, I'll let you pick who you want to be on the right and who you want to be on the left. How nice. But here's the other aspect of this. She's asking this rooted out of faith that there is going to be a kingdom. And yet at the same time, she's looking at the kingdom in light of what? A position. That's great that there's going to be this kingdom. Can my son sit on your right hand, your left hand? And all of a sudden, what's a great spiritual understanding now turns into a self-seeking concept. We've gotten off the rail. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you this. Don't think that James and John are sitting over there going, oh. Don't imagine that, because Mark's account doesn't even mention about their mother being there. And they say it themselves. So don't get caught up in that thought. But here's what I do want you to take note of. Verse 22. But Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." Now, Mark's account goes on to talk about Jesus says, "Are you able to be baptized with the same baptism that I'm going to be baptized in?" And what something is, outside of Judas, the 12 apostles, the first apostle to be martyred because of standing for Jesus and his word is James. In Acts chapter 12, it talks about James is beheaded by Herod. And so you realize, is he going to go through something very difficult? Yes. And Peter is even, as Acts chapter 12 continues, Peter is considering that he may be next. Because Herod saw how much the Jews loved it whenever he killed James. Well, let's gain some more political, conditioning here, and I'll just kill another one. And remember, the saints are praying, and God actually leads Peter out of prison by the hands of an angel, and leads right to Rhoda's house. And all of a sudden, here he is knocking on the door, and they don't believe that he's actually there. Isn't that something? They're praying for him to be released, and he's standing at the door, but they don't believe it until they open the door, and there he is. Now, you think about it on the flip side. What about for John? How are things going to go for John? He is. And you think in those terms that is John going to be persecuted? Yes, to the point that he's going to be taken captive to the Isle of Patmos, which is where he writes the book of Revelation. James is going to write, I'm going to assume this, I don't know whether you think the same way or not, but the book of James in the New Testament, what does it start off talking about? He says, "Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials, knowing the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result so that you can be perfect and complete and lacking in nothing. And if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God." Because you just realize, it's about going through persecution. And you go, here's James writing, and probably one of the first books written in the New Testament, chronologically. And you go, is he going to suffer? He's going to be killed by Herod. Is John going to suffer? Yes, and by the way, John is the only apostle. This is just historically. This is not scripture. It only deals with a few of the apostles' death in the scriptures. John is the only one traditionally who doesn't die by the hands of somebody else. He's the only one who's considered to have died what we would say of natural causes. And so you understand, yet he's going to write the book of Revelation. He's going to write the Gospel of John. He's going to write 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. You go, but it doesn't mean he's not going to go through a lot of difficulties for it. Now, we know how these things go. Pam. Yes, that is correct. Boanerges is the name that's given, which translated means sons of thunder, which tells you, were they known as calm, cool, and collected kind of guys? No. I mean, they were hot-headed guys. Even to the point where when somebody won't let Jesus stay in their town, he says, do you want us to call down lightning from heaven to destroy him? And Jesus rebukes him. He says, you don't even know what spirit you're of. We didn't come to destroy people. We came to bring them to salvation. Now, so you see how the lives of James and John are going to go. But notice what's here. So in verse 22, he says, you do not know what you are asking. Hasn't Jesus just told them what he's about to go through? He says, and you're wanting this? He says, are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? Now, are you ready to be crucified with me? Now, you know the answer they're about to say, but I'm going to take you to reality here in a moment. Their response to that question is what? We're able. We can do it. You can count on us. Whenever Jesus is arrested, what did James and John do? They run. So, are they saying in their words what they're really going to do in the near future? No. But after Jesus is raised from the dead, you're going to see a different spirit in James and John, aren't you? Here's what he puts forward. And I want you to think about the context of where we are. What's Jesus really saying? Are you able to drink this cup? Are you ready to put yourself last? And what's their response? We're able. Verse 23. He said to them, my cup you shall drink. Were they going to be persecuted? Yes, James even to death. He says, my cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give. But it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. I thought you were the king. I thought you were going to be the king. Think about this. How many times do we want to promise things we don't have authority to promise? And yet here is the mother of James and John coming and saying, I want my sons to sit on your right hand and on your left hand. I know your kingdom's coming. I understand you're going to be king. You just say it so and it'll be so. And then Jesus in the end, he asks, well, what do you wish? Now he says, that's not for me to give. That is not for me to give. There are other times in Jesus' life where you see him do this exact same thing. There's some kinfolks who are fighting over an inheritance, and one of the sons comes to Jesus and says, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Remember what Jesus' response is? Who made me arbitrator or judge over you? He says, does your brother think that I have authority over that too? And he says, be leery of greed. He says, it may swallow you up. Well, anytime people start dividing inheritances, well, there's a big thing to remember. Am I being greedy? Now, Jesus understands his authority and who gives him the authority. He says, there are some things in my kingdom that are not mine to give. And sure enough, this statement, once again, what is Jesus reflecting? Is he going to put himself first? Or is that God's place? Because that's his. Now, he says, for those to whom it has been prepared by my Father. And the idea is, God has been passively preparing people for this moment. I don't know if you've ever been able to get into a situation in life. Sometimes I kind of marvel at it. To see a teenage girl who loves taking care of children, and she wants to babysit kids and feed them and change them and take care of diapers and do all those kind of things, and you realize, what is she becoming prepared for? For being a mother. And then there are other little girls who are scared to death of kids and holding them, and all of a sudden they become a mother and everything is brand new. And you go, still a mother, but not quite as prepared. And when are you ever fully prepared to be a father or a mother? But you see how this lays out. This is not preparing to be a father or mother. He says, there are people who are going to go through. Now, I want you to think about it. Who is going to suffer the most that we know about of the apostles? It's someone who's not even an apostle at this point in time. It's going to be Paul. Is he being prepared? I want you to think in his terms. He's going to be a persecutor of God's own people. He's going to get a front row seat for watching the conviction of God's people to endure persecution. And then whenever he's converted in the book of Acts, you find a man who is not going to let down. He doesn't care whether he's going to be stoned to death. He doesn't care whether they beat him with rods. He doesn't care if he's thrown in prison. He is going to continue to be faithful because he knows he has to finish this race. Even though he's an outsider, God was still preparing Saul. And if you remember, whenever Saul is converted and Ananias is going to be sent to him, remember what God tells Ananias? He is a chosen instrument because he was being prepared. And isn't it beautiful in life when you've been prepared for a moment that you were clueless about that was coming, and then the moment hits and you go, the Lord is preparing me for this all along. Didn't even know. Karen. Right. And it's amazing how when you look back over life, you just see the Lord's been working things together that we didn't even recognize he was doing to prepare us for a moment. And in the same way, these apostles were being prepared. They're getting to see Jesus, even an apostle born out of season like Paul or Saul. And so here it is. He says, look, this position about what you're going to suffer, he says, it's not mine to give. To be on the right hand or the left. And I'm not telling you who ended up on the right or the left. I can't tell you that part of Jesus. But here it is. He says, for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father. And been prepared is the actions are in the past and passively happening to be prepared for the moment at hand. Just marvelous. Verse 24. Staying in the same thing. Well, let's see what the others think about this conversation. And hearing this, and what did they just hear? About being last. They just heard Jesus say, it's not mine to give. He says, this is what my Father is going to do. That's his choice. And hearing this, the ten became indignant with the two brothers. Give me a definition of indignant. Smug, puffed up, angry. I mean, really indignant is an intensified word for anger. Probably in our own language, we would not just say they were mad or they were angry. We would say their blood was boiling. Or we would say they were raging mad. And that's the idea. But what something is, they only get that way because they didn't hear what Jesus said. What did they pay attention to? They paid attention to the situation and the conversation except for what Jesus actually said. Because Jesus had just told them, it is not for me to give. So what are they so angry about? You asked. Okay. But then I want you to notice how Jesus takes this situation. He knows what the ten have come, the two have come for, along with their mother. And now the ten are just as angry as they can be that this conversation even happened. How dare you bring your mother here? Then, verse 25. So notice what Jesus does. But Jesus called them to himself and said, now, he calls the whole group together again, all 12 of them. Ten are indignant against James and John. And I want you to realize, no matter which one of the ten or all of the ten you want to think about, they're all angry. I mean, they're really angry about this. So, I mean, all right, let's turn this into a present day example. Workforce meeting. Job is going to open up of some kind of seniority. And you're there to hear the same thing. And this person who you feel like is probably not the best qualified person says to the boss, you know, I think I'd really like to have that position when it becomes open. And you go, why am I upset? Why does it upset me? If I've really put myself last, then whenever those things come, how are they going to work out? They'll work out the best way. It doesn't always mean that you get the job. But I think we've all been in enough situations in life to where you've been around some of those things. And then to go, I've seen it go in different directions. Sure have. Now, notice, verse 25. But Jesus called them to himself and said, you know, and you know it by experience. You've seen it with your own eyes. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. How did control happen? Who did Herod hand off control to? His son, also named Herod. And who did that Herod hand off control to? Also to his son named Herod. It had been through three different generations. And you go, there was a Herod that aimed to kill Jesus whenever he was born. There is a Herod that killed John the Baptist. There's a Herod in the book of Acts who actually kills James. You go, here's just one generation after another. And just to give you a little bit of a timeline, whenever James is killed in Acts chapter 12, it's around AD 44. It could have been a year or two earlier than that. But you're talking about within 10 years of Jesus making this statement, James is going to be dead. 10 to 11 years. And you want to know the one thing that's important? Is James going to be willing to put himself last? Is he going to still stand for what's true and what's holy before God? And you realize these are the mindsets that these men outside of Judas are going to have. They're learning a lesson. They're being prepared. They don't get it in the moment. But they're going to get it when we come to the book of Acts. Then, he says, you know how it works with the rulers of the Gentiles. They lord it over them. Their great men exercise authority over them. They don't get to say, well, do you want to serve me? And you go back to that same work type example. You know what it's like whenever there are people in the office who have applied for this job, and you start thinking, oh, well, I hope this person gets it. Or, oh, it'd be great. Oh, it'd be terrible if that person got it. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes in from the outside. And you go, oh, I didn't see that coming. And then they have two choices as a leader. They can start lording it over everybody who's in the office. And how does that go? There'll be some people who go, I like that idea. We'll be in this together. Can I be your right hand? Then you have other people who come in and they decide how are they going to lead. Humility and service. How can I help you perform your job better? How can I serve you? What are you lacking that that can be provided in the budget that would help you. Interesting. It's amazing how it still works today, even outside of what we think of as the religious world. You know what people want? They want servant-minded leaders. They want leaders who are willing to put themselves last, as opposed to those who want to put themselves first. He says, the Gentiles lord it over them. Then, verse 26, Jesus gives the wisdom. He says, it is not this way among you. Don't worry about James and John's mother. It's not going to work this way among you. You don't get to just come in and ask and it's given to you. He says, that's up to my Father. He says, it is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. If you want to be great, go be great. Put yourself last. What are they angry about? They thought it was going to work the same way the world works, as opposed to, you can be great, go serve. What I think is kind of fun is the last word of verse 27 in the King James Version is minister. Some people look at ministers as, oh, look at the elevator, look what they do, they have all this authority. No. That's not what Jesus intended. What's a minister supposed to do? Serve. Who do they serve first? God. We're going to keep His commands. That's what we're going to teach. That's what we're going to go after. And to realize, and then I'm going to serve. Now, you look at that. I just use that as an example to know what you should be looking for. Because same thing can happen. A new minister comes in. You've got two choices. Wow, this church needs to learn a lot. They need to understand these principles. And they start lording it over them. How's that go? What about coming in and just serving? Look at Jesus. Then notice this next aspect. And the same thing goes for everyone. Like I said, I'm just using that as an example. But going, you really want to be great? Put yourself last. Verse 27. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Wow. You want to know who people did not esteem in the first century? They didn't esteem slaves. But what were slaves to do? So if you want to be first, he says, you need to think of yourself as a slave toward God. A slave of His. For I am here to ask, what does God desire of me? Not to go, I have my own thinking, and if I can fit in what He wants, I'll do it. He says, whoever wishes to be first among you. What's He telling those 12? If you want it, it's there for the taking. You're just going to have to change the way you think. Verse 28. Just as, he says, and I'm going to tell you about who's going to put themselves last. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give His life a ransom for many. He says, here's why I came. I came to serve. I didn't come to be, my goal is not, I'm king, listen to me. Shut up and listen to me. He doesn't say that. Not once. Now they needed to do that, but it's not what he says. He says, I didn't come to be served. I came to serve. I came to put myself last. If we're going to imitate Jesus, where do we have to be? Last. You know what? It seems like it gets all crowded at the top, doesn't it? You want to know where there's plenty of room and space for? at the bottom. Plenty of opportunities to serve. And so you notice it here. He says, and in the end, because Jesus is going to put himself last, what's he going to be able to do for us or for many? A ransom. And literally this word for ransom means to loosen. It's what lets you loose of what binds you. Isn't that something? How many people want to be loosed? How do you get freed? Put yourself last. People wonder why things get so stressful at the office. Everybody wants to be first. You step back and be last and go, I'll clean the toilet. Usually not a long line. Realize, I'll do the dirty work. And people go, that's great, we'll let you. And you realize all of a sudden, other people look around and go, you know what? You may not be getting anywhere in that job. We'd love to have you on our team. We need more people like that. And all of a sudden you go, how did you get that job over there? You didn't do anything in our office. Just worked out by the Lord's grace. Listening to him. Then, verse 29. Out of all the people. Verse 29. As they were leaving Jericho, Jericho is about 13 and a half miles away from Jerusalem. And by the way, it's uphill all the way to Jerusalem. What's funny is if you look it up, this is one of those mathematical oddities. If it takes you 7 to 9 hours to get from Jericho to Jerusalem, how many hours do you think it takes to get from Jerusalem to Jericho? You would think, it takes the same amount of time. It's the same distance. Nope, it's downhill from Jerusalem. You can get to Jericho a whole lot quicker. So have fun with that. So here they are. They're leaving Jericho, and you know they're headed to Jerusalem. And when you get to chapter 21, Jesus only has 1 week left to live. Give you a little time stamp. Chapter 21, when Jesus comes into Jerusalem, it's Sunday, and he's going to die on Friday. So it gives you a little idea. Then, verse 29. A large crowd followed him. Oh, big following. Big following with Jesus. And they're probably trampling over each other to be first. Don't know that. Maybe not. Verse 30. And two blind men sitting by the road, hearing that Jesus was passing by, cried out, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. Mercy. We just asked for mercy. Mercy is a word about we deserve some form of discipline, but not to be given to us. Now, they're blind men, but they also recognize this is the Lord. He has control over these situations. Now, if you want to know how they would know that, in Matthew chapter 9, there's another story that happened several years back, like probably 2 or 3 years before this, where there were some blind men who were also there who wanted to regain their sight. And what something is, you know what they also cried out about? Son of David, have mercy on us. It's as if they had heard this is the way he operates. Because those things travel, don't they? Especially if you're someone who's blind. Wouldn't you pay attention? Now, he says, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. They knew about this relationship. And in Malachi chapter 4, it talks about the son, S-O-N, of righteousness is going to come, and he's going to come with healing in his wings. Who do you think fulfilled that? Jesus Christ the righteous. He says, they cry out. Verse 31, what does the crowd think about these people? And this is the most politically correct way I know of saying this. The crowd sternly told them to be quiet. What does that translate to in your mind? Shut up. The crowd sternly told them to be quiet. And what did they do? They cried out all the more. It's as if they were already crying out and they're told to sternly be quiet and they kick it up to another gear. Because what do they know? Can anybody else change this for them? No. This is the opportunity. This is the opportunity. Now, where did the crowd put these blind men? At the bottom. They said, you guys shut up. You guys be quiet. You are not even worthy to talk to him. They said, you need to know your place. Isn't that what they're saying? Or at least communicating. And they cry out all the more, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. They haven't changed their tune. Then notice verse 32. And what does Jesus do? Stopped. When you put yourself last, Jesus stops. Many people wish somebody would just stop. Jesus puts himself last again. And Jesus stopped and called them. Called them. He called them by voice. And what's interesting in other accounts of this, they got up and they came to him. He didn't necessarily do everything for them. He calls for them and they got up and came to him. Read about it in the other gospel accounts. And notice what Jesus asked them. What do you want me to do for you? Now, in other accounts of this story, it's the same chapter where they come. It's Mark chapter 10. And the stories are still there both about James and John coming to Jesus. They have a request and Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? And then later on after that story, there's this same story about these two blind men. And they come up to Jesus and Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? James and John ask a selfish question. Then you get these blind men who ask a question too. So what do you want me to do for you? And then they give this statement. Verse 33. They said to him, Lord, we want our eyes to be opened. And you'll see a motive here in a second. He says, we want to see. And if they're allowed to see, what's the first thing they'll see? Their Creator. Right there. We want our eyes to be opened. Verse 34. Moved with compassion. And every time you see that word compassion in the gospel accounts, it's always about a trigger that's about to bring an action. It's not just a mere emotion or feeling. It's a trigger for an action. Moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes. I kind of get this image. It talks about both of them rather than one at a time, but could it be either way? Jesus touched their eyes and immediately they regained their sight. I think the first thing they saw was the fingerprints of Jesus. Can you imagine? Now, here's what they see. And then what is their heart's desire? What do they do next? Follow him. We want to follow you. They don't just want to be healed. They want to be healed so that they can put him first. Now, think back to the parable that was earlier in the chapter. Remember that group that showed up with just 1 hour to go in the day? Where do you think these two blind men fit into that parable? Because the very next chapter is going to be about the last week of Jesus. Who showed up last? These two blind men. And they're made well. And what are they going to be paid? They're going to be given the same gift as the apostles who have been there all along. Isn't that something? And you go, here they are, all the things they had to deal with, being blind, being put out by the side of the road, and then now here they come in. And what's so wonderful is we'll see it, Lord willing, next week. In chapter 21, there's going to come a time where Jesus is going to be praised by the crowds. And you know what they're going to be calling him? The Son of David. I wonder who's saying it with him. Look at the influence. Look at how this works. So I hope you see how this fits together, all together, about you want to put yourself last. Where will God take you? He'll take you to the first. Jesus showed us the way. If we'll just listen and imitate him. All right. Next week we'll come back, start in chapter 21. We'll see some more tithes as we go. All right. Thank you.